This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
News broadcasters in Afghanistan had a lot of freedom and leeway over the past two decades. Now journalists are being threatened and beaten up by the Taliban.
These guys have been trained to kill and destroy, not to police a city of 7 million people.
Still, the news in Afghanistan is getting out. Plus, what leverage do foreign governments have over the Taliban?
We have to be very clear, if we're going to use the word leverage, what exactly this means and what means do we have to actually implement this leverage.
Also today, we look at COVID vaccine patents through the lens of Africa in the 1990s and the legal battle to get lower-priced drugs to treat AIDS.
We wanted to know that are they getting away with the murder or are they allowing us to get treatment in a cheaper way because we were dying.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's been 1 month now since the Taliban captured Kabul. Taliban officials call themselves the rightful leaders of Afghanistan, even though they grabbed power by military force. An interim Taliban government is in place, but the Taliban appear to be well on their way to governing the entire country of more than 30 million people. One big question remains, though. Should the international community recognize the Taliban as the legitimate government in Afghanistan? The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
This is not the first time governments have had to answer that question. In 1996, the scenes in Kabul were not too different from today. The Taliban rolled into the capital and took over by force. But not all of Afghanistan was under their control. Parts of the country resisted, mainly in the north. The former president even continued to represent Afghanistan at the United Nations.
And because you still had that continuity of that claim of government and other parts of Afghan territory that Taliban didn't quite fully control, the United States and the international community resisted recognizing them.
Scott Anderson is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Only three countries recognized the Taliban in the 1990s, Pakistan, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. For the most part, Afghanistan under Taliban rule was an international pariah. More than two decades later, the world finds itself in a similar predicament. Governments are weighing whether or not to officially recognize a group that took power by force. The Taliban has put together an interim government that's not inclusive and has members who are on the international sanctions and wanted lists. As for the Taliban, Scott Anderson says they need international recognition.
Recognition brings governments, or regimes, I suppose, once they're recognized as governments, a lot of international legal benefits.
Diplomatic immunity, for example, would give Taliban officials the ability to travel outside the country without the risk of being arrested.
That's actually a big issue for the Taliban because figures involved in their current interim government, such as the head of the Haqqani Network, who's the new interior ministry, are wanted criminals in a good part of the world.
There are other benefits, too. If the U.S. recognizes the Taliban, then they can eventually get access to Afghanistan's financial assets in the United States. This week, Secretary of State Antony Blinken was asked if the Taliban is the legitimate government of Afghanistan.
It is the de facto government of Afghanistan.
In other words, whatever the Biden administration does, the Taliban is now in charge of Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the European Union hasn't decided on the issue yet either, says Judy Dempsey. She's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and is based in Berlin.
The discussion is on two levels. On the highest political level, there's now a consensus that the European Union should start sending humanitarian aid and assistance to the Afghan people. But there's also an awareness that in some ways this will legitimize the Taliban government. But the Europeans are doing this out of the sake of the owe to the Afghan people, and they're doing it out of self-interest. They don't want a flood of refugees.
At the same time, Dempsey says many in Europe just want to wash their hands of Afghanistan and focus on fixing problems at home. Some experts say foreign governments can use recognition and humanitarian aid as leverage to pressure the Taliban on human rights. Dempsey says she's not convinced.
We have to be very clear if we're going to use the word leverage, what exactly this means, and what means do we have to actually implement this leverage.
Some powers in the region are making their own calculations based on their interests. Russia and Iran, for example, are keeping their embassies open in Kabul. Pakistan has had a long relationship with the Taliban. And in the northeast, China is taking stock of the situation. Ian Johnson is a China expert with the Council on Foreign Relations.
China's primary interest in Afghanistan is security. It shares a small border with Afghanistan and is worried about the perceived threat of terrorism that could emanate from there.
China also sees some potential economic benefits in Afghanistan, like in mining and infrastructure. For its part, Afghanistan could really use China's help.
The West has mainly cut off aid, and as we know, Afghanistan is highly dependent on aid for its economy. So if China can step in and maybe not replace the West, but at least keep the coffers somewhat filled, then that would be really, really important. And I think of the countries that could do that, China is the main one. Russia would probably like to do something like that. But I think Russia lacks the financial muscle, economic muscle to do that kind of thing.
The Afghan people, of course, are caught in the middle of all this. On the one hand, recognition from the international community would help the economy. But for those Afghans who despise the Taliban, formal recognition for the group would mean a betrayal. This week, about 24 former Afghan diplomats put out a statement asking the international community not to recognize the Taliban. The Taliban, meanwhile, are doing their own outreach. They met with UN officials and asked for all sanctions to be lifted and all financial assets to be unfrozen. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Tolo News is Afghanistan's most popular and hard-hitting broadcaster. In recent years, millions of Afghans have tuned in for its talk shows, Turkish soap operas, and wide-ranging news coverage. But under Taliban rule, its very existence is now in question. Saad Mohseini heads the Mobi Group, the media company that owns Tolo News. He recently arrived in the U.S., and he joins us from New York. Saad Mohseini, first off, can you describe how much freedom and independence Tolo News had before the U.S. departed from Afghanistan?
Well, it wasn't absolute. Like any country, we have to abide by local laws. So we obviously pushed the envelope as much as we could on social, cultural, and political issues. You know, relative to the region, I think Afghanistan had the freest market when you compare Afghanistan to India, the Middle East, Central Asia, all of Africa, and even some countries in Eastern Europe. So media was a true success story in Afghanistan.
Saad, in what way did Tolo really push the envelope in Afghanistan when it started?
We had female hosts and DJs and presenters, and that in itself in the early days was a big challenge to the status quo. Don't forget, in 2001, there was no television. Radio stations just used to air religious songs. So by just coming on air in 2003 and having female DJs and then presenters on television in 2004, that in itself sort of helped change things on the ground. And of course, our entertainment-type programs, our soap operas, all of these things sort of incrementally changed the way that people saw themselves.
What about now, since the Taliban has taken over? What sort of freedom of movement does your staff have now?
Afghanistan seems a lot more secure, so you can actually travel quite easily right across the country. Nonetheless, they have to be careful because, you know, local authorities have their own policies. On the news side, there's probably not much difference in terms of our reporting. On the entertainment side, because we have five networks, on the entertainment side, you know, we've pulled all music clips for a period. We've started again with fairly conservative music, classical music performed by men. And we've also have pulled some of the risque shows, like Turkish soap operas. But we've tried to, you know, keep things as they were as much as possible. It may not be easy, especially on the entertainment side, but we are trying.
On the news side right now, if you tune into Tolo, will you see female anchors and female reporters?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You'll see female reporters. You will see female presenters for both news and the entertainment programs like the morning show and so forth. And you will see us covering all sorts of issues, people being critical of the Taliban's policies on vis-a-vis women, sporadic fighting across the country, a lot less than, say, a couple of weeks ago when there was real resistance in Panjshir. You know, and we have these debate programs. It's quite interesting that there are women inside the studio criticizing the Taliban. There are women outside the country, so they're defending the Taliban. It's a really interesting environment. The Taliban are being pushed to respond to the way that, you know, they're treating women. And by being challenged, they have to, in some ways, come up with their policies. You know, more and more, they're holding press conferences. I'm not saying they're as transparent as they should be, but we're seeing some signs that maybe they're reacting to things.
We know that when the Taliban first entered Kabul last month, they went to your offices and took away all the state-issued weapons that your staffers were using to protect themselves. The Taliban fighters then offered their own protection. Your staffers turned that offer down. What was that moment like?
It was very scary. I mean, I was getting live feedback from our guys on the ground, and we were not sure how they would react, but they came in, and I think their job was to confiscate anything that belonged to the state, weapons, vehicles, residential dwellings, office space. So they had clear instructions to do that, but they were respectful. They didn't come into the actual building. They actually just roamed the compound, and they left soon after. And then, of course, subsequent to that visit, we had a visit from their media commission members. That was a lot more civilized. And since then, we have this ongoing relationship with them, mostly with the media commission folks. You know, they're sort of being forced to address certain issues, kicking and screaming. And they run the country now. And that's a fact that we cannot ignore while we run our TV networks.
But do they interfere with your programming or come to your offices or question what you're broadcasting or want approval of things?
Not yet. And I don't think it's because they're wonderful, open-minded individuals who wish to see free media prosper. It's mostly because I don't think they have the bandwidth. They probably will draft, you know, their own version of media laws. They will issue directives. So long ways to go.
We've seen a lot of violence directed toward journalists in the past week in Afghanistan, with journalists beaten and flogged. Aren't you concerned about that? I mean, how are you keeping your own people safe?
You know, you have no guarantees. You know, we had a couple of journalists beaten up 2 weeks ago, and, you know, we told them all, you're not going to move. We have to stay put. We can't risk you going out and being exposed to this really new and wild environment. It's like the Wild West sometimes. These guys have been trained to kill and destroy, not to police a city of 7 million people.
What about your female hosts? How are you dealing with them or providing protection for them?
It's difficult. It's challenging. For example, they issued this edict that female employees of the government should not go to work for a period until they sort out the security and everything. And then all of a sudden, you know, we have to deal with this challenge of explaining to Taliban security personnel at checkpoints that these women didn't work for the government. They worked for a private organization. Just communicating that, we felt, was a challenge. But somehow we managed to get our girls into the studios. And now most of our female employees can go out and do vox pops on the streets, can go and interview officials and ministries. But there's always a likelihood that someone's going to issue the edict tomorrow and things can change completely.
Saad Mohseini, what's your biggest worry today?
The safety of our staff, being able to continue. I hate to think that some of our gains of the last two decades will be lost. And, you know, once people lose hope, that somehow, you know, the fear is that we will go back to the mid-1990s.
Saad Mohseini heads the Mobi Group, the media company that owns Tolo News, Afghanistan's leading broadcaster. He's been speaking to us from New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Some breaking news about Afghanistan. Pentagon officials said today that the deadly strike targeting Islamic State extremists on August 29th went terribly wrong. A Hellfire missile hit the wrong vehicle, and as many as 10 civilians were killed, including up to 7 children. The Pentagon is calling it a tragic mistake. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. One of the surest ways to halt the spread of the coronavirus and mutations is to get the entire globe vaccinated. To date, nearly 6 billion shots have been administered worldwide, but the distribution has been anything but equitable. Africa has received just 2% of those shots. Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, addressed that this week.
That's not because African countries don't have the capacity or experience to roll out vaccines. It's because they have been left behind by the rest of the world.
It's why people around the world have been calling for a waiver on COVID-19 patents. The World's Alana Gordon has researched the history of waivers and what they tell us about the present moment. Alana, what's the talk of a current waiver about?
So under the current system, companies that develop the shots get a patent or the exclusive rights for a certain number of years. And then during that time, they control who manufactures the vaccines, where they're distributed, at what price, and when. Now, this waiver, Carol, would temporarily change that structure. It would lift the patents, and that way, in theory, it would open the door for independent manufacturers, like in the Global South, to make vaccines too and expand the supply.
So this was proposed nearly a year ago at the World Trade Organization. What's up with it now?
So it's really controversial, and it's still being debated. But the thing is, it all requires a global consensus at the WTO to pass.
What's the stalemate about?
Well, many stress that the patent structure really incentivizes innovation and research. I mean, these COVID vaccines, Carol, they've been a total lifeline for the world. And also, these new vaccines are complicated. They require special expertise. But at the same time, the waiver proposal did not come out of the blue. There's a precedent for it. I recently dug into the story of a patent conflict that dates back 20 years, and it's one of the most high-profile cases.
Let's hear it.
So in the 1990s, a different virus was killing millions of people around the world, HIV and AIDS. Mandisa Mbali is a historian in Cape Town, South Africa. At the time, she was a college student in Durban.
On campus, there seemed to always be obituary notices. Many of the students who passed away were young women.
South Africa had the highest number of infections. It was the epicenter of this global pandemic. Hazel Tao was 26 back then when she learned she was HIV positive. The diagnosis turned her life upside down.
I was divorced. I was destitute. The house was sold without my consent. Everything was just a mess up because of my status.
Tao was terrified at the thought of getting sick. At the same time, this prominent human rights and health activist, Mark Haywood, was observing a troubling trend. New HIV treatments were literally bringing people back to life. But that was only happening in higher income countries.
In our countries, those medicines were unaffordable, completely out of the price range of even middle class individuals.
A full round of these amazing treatments could cost about $10,000. They were inaccessible for most South Africans, including Tao.
I know that one of the days, it will be me who needed the treatment.
The Global Intellectual Property System, under the newly formed World Trade Organization, affirmed that in most cases, companies control the manufacturing, the price, and where the drugs can be imported from and exported to. Haywood learned that some of those drugs cost a lot less in places that made generic versions. He wanted South Africa to have the ability to import cheaper alternatives or make their own.
We weren't against intellectual property per se. What we say we're against is the abuse of intellectual property when it violates people's fundamental rights.
Historian Mandisa Mbali says this issue gained national traction. South Africa was in this dramatic moment, a peaceful democratic transition with a new president, Nelson Mandela, and a new constitution.
This amazing constitution that guaranteed the right to access to healthcare services.
In 1997, the government moved forward legislation to create a legal avenue for the country to override medicine patents. The policy faced pushback right away. The U.S. considered threatening trade sanctions if the act moved forward. Mark Haywood says then came the formal challenge.
What happened was that, you know, as soon as that law was introduced, passed by Parliament, 42 pharmaceutical companies, all of them based outside of South Africa, interdicted that legislation, took it to court.
In the winter of 1998, pharmaceutical companies and their leading trade group launched a legal challenge against the government of South Africa. They argued that the law circumvented global patent protections. Haywood's group joined the government's defense, submitting an amicus brief.
The courtroom in those days was filled, literally filled, with hundreds of people living with HIV, listening to the arguments.
Outside, protests erupted. Hazel Tao was there.
We wanted to know that are they getting away with a murder or are they allowing us to get treatment in a cheaper way because we were dying.
There were global days of action, demonstrations.
Brooke Baker is a law professor at Northeastern University.
All around the world, including here in Boston, organized by myself and others to support the South African demand that the industry drop the case.
The whole lawsuit galvanized a global access to medicines movement and became a global PR nightmare for drug companies. In the spring of 2001, the companies dropped the case. As a result, companies lowered drug prices across Africa. They granted more generic licenses to other manufacturers to make HIV meds. Northeastern's Brooke Baker.
And it put pressure on drug companies to start doing things voluntarily that they had not done before.
The U.S. launched massive programs to subsidize cheap AIDS drugs in Africa. The WTO further clarified that countries have a right to override patents under certain circumstances. Fast forward to today, 25 years after Hazel Tao was diagnosed with HIV, she has a new fear with COVID-19.
We are going back to the very same situation we go with HIV.
Those around her lack access to vaccines. A handful of companies hold the exclusive rights. Now, South Africa is a co-sponsor of this new proposal to waive COVID-19 patents. And at the forefront of the push for greater access are some of the very same activists and policy leaders from 20 years ago.
So, Alana, that's quite a story. What is different about today's situation?
Well, COVID is a different kind of infectious disease. Every place in the world wants and needs these vaccines. There's higher demand, limited manufacturing. Richer countries have really dominated the market for them.
But if I'm understanding this history correctly, countries can already override patents and make drugs. Why do they need this sweeping waiver now?
There are these examples of countries that have used these waivers, but it's actually not used very much. I talked with patent experts about the broader reasons why. In lower-income countries, they may still face threats of retaliation and sanctions if they try to do it. And the other issue is that they'd need to set up laws and then specific legislation to override each patent on a specific drug.
So I guess the idea is that an across-the-board waiver that everybody agrees on and the WTO agrees on, that would get all of those other obstacles out of the way and protect countries from backlash?
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea.
But would a waiver in itself lead to more vaccines?
People I've talked to say a lot of other things have to happen. Places need the infrastructure to make medicines and vaccines. And so that's why we're also seeing a big push to create new manufacturing hubs in places like South Africa and for global superpowers to step up and help fund them. And these outside manufacturers would need the technology and the kind of expertise that the developers have. Carol, we'll be hearing a lot more about these issues of access in the coming weeks at the UN General Assembly.
Incredibly interesting. The World's Alana Gordon. Thank you.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to The World. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau rolled the dice when he called a snap election. Will his gamble pay off?
I mean, this is what I love about Canadian elections is there's so many questions right now. The Prime Minister, after he called the election, had a really steep drop in the polls because I think Canadians really didn't want the election.
Plus, remembering a man known as the Chicano Woody Guthrie, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Russians are going to the polls starting today through Sunday to vote in their parliamentary elections. Leading up to the vote, authorities have cracked down on independent politicians across Russia, making sure that the Kremlin's loudest critics wouldn't run. Many opposition politicians have fled abroad or have even been imprisoned, including opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Experts have also speculated for years that elections in Russia are rigged in favor of President Vladimir Putin's ruling party, United Russia, which has controlled the Duma for the last decade and a half. Ekaterina Shulman is a Russian political scientist in Moscow. Ekaterina, what will you be tracking over the next couple of days as Russians go to the polls?
I'd be interested in two things, in voters' turnout, what is the activity, and signs of possible falsifications. Despite the crackdown that you have mentioned, hundreds of thousands of Russians are volunteering as election observers. So we'll be pretty sure to know if something really out of the way happens. What makes these elections different is the record low popularity of the party of parliamentary majority.
And that's the ruling part of the United Russia Party. So you mentioned that United Russia, Putin's party, that it's not very popular. So do you think people who don't support it will vote for another party, or will they simply not vote at all?
Well, the goal, the ideal of Russian federal political management would be for these people to stay at home, of course. The usual tactic has been to ensure that every dissatisfied or oppositionally minded voter will be so disgusted with the campaign, will see so little to choose from, that he or she will naturally choose rather to stay at home. How will it play out in this election? The only honest answer will be, we do not know. On the last elections in 2019 in Moscow, the oppositional electorate suddenly turned out. And so this changed the face of Moscow City Parliament. Quite a few people appeared that were elected either from Yabloko, the Liberal Party, or from the so-called Systemic Party, but with the support of Alexei Navalny's smart voting system.
I was just going to ask you about the smart voting system of Alexei Navalny. What is it?
It's a political instrument which allows to channel this widespread voters' discontent into voting for one candidate or one party, which is likely to do most harm or possibly even to win over the incumbent or the ruling party, United Russia, or the candidate supported by the authorities.
Ekaterina, I've got to ask you this. There's often been an argument whether or not it's worth voting in these elections in Russia. Alexei Navalny's team would say it's worth voting as a protest against Putin and his party. Others say boycotting sends a stronger message. What do you think? Will you vote?
I will. I will vote as a citizen. I always participate in elections for any legislative assembly. This is what I study. And therefore, I know what difference can even a single member of parliament make. I know their powers, which they quite often do not use. I know what is it to have the right of a legislative initiative to be able to introduce bills into the Duma. So why I was telling you the story of Moscow City Duma. If we have the same situation on the federal level, we'll have 5 or 6 or 10 or 12 deputies who will take their duties seriously. It will make a huge difference. I, again, both as a citizen and as an expert, I do need somebody in the Duma whom we can at least talk to.
Many people have claimed that these elections are really a sham orchestrated by Putin to solidify his legitimacy. What's your view? Are they basically a sham?
Well, Russia is, as I have said, an electoral autocracy. Electoral autocracies can neither completely get rid of elections nor win them honestly. So they are cursed with the duty to imitate them. It is an important task which shows to the people that the power has still the legitimacy of popular support, and it's a kind of a training session for the political machine itself. It needs to deliver the necessary results without unnecessary scandal, trouble, expense, or showing a bad picture. So elections are not, of course, either honest or competitive or likely to result in a change of power immediately. Neither are they completely sham. That is something so imitative that it has no connections either with people's lives or with the real political decisions.
Do you think there's a chance that people will protest after the results of the elections are out? I mean, if it goes back to the status quo, are Russians at a point where they've kind of had it?
There are two things that are not likely to happen during these elections. First is the loss of majority by the United Russia Party, and the second, widespread popular protest after the elections results are announced. Russian authorities are not so simple-minded as those of Belarus. They will not likely announce that United Russia got 80% of votes. All the signals we've been hearing from the collective Kremlin boil down to, please do not overdo it. So 40% will be considered a positive result. And this is done exactly for the reason you mentioned, in order not to provoke mass protests, in order not to provoke popular discontent. It's not enough to announce a result. You need to sell it to society. People need to believe that although elections are not completely honest, and this is well known, Russians are not naive. They know that there are falsifications. But still, that an honest result, if it were available, would not differ that much from the official result. This is the legitimacy which electoral autocracies strive to attain.
Ekaterina Shulman is a Russian political scientist in Moscow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since we recorded this interview, Russian authorities have successfully pressured Google and Apple to remove Alexei Navalny's Smart Vote app from their platforms. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the app is illegal. One of Navalny's top aides, Ivan Zhdanov, said on Twitter that removing the Navalny app from stores is a shameful act of political censorship. He said Russia's authoritarian government and propaganda will be thrilled. Apple and Google did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Large tech companies like Apple, Google, Facebook, and Twitter have struggled with striking a balance between following local rules versus allowing access to their content, especially in authoritarian countries. In this case, Apple and Google removed the Navalny app after Russian authorities threatened the companies with fines and criminal prosecution in Russia. President Biden met virtually with world leaders today to talk climate change. One specific ask was for them to sign on to a pledge to cut methane emissions by about a third this decade. It's the latest in a flurry of diplomatic efforts to try and secure some tangible results at the next UN climate summit. That happens in Glasgow in 6 weeks. The summit has been described as the last best shot to keep ambitious climate targets in play. The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has a report.
Most of the greenhouse gas emissions in the world come from just a few rich countries. President Biden spoke today to leaders of more than a dozen of them in his latest diplomatic bid for faster action on climate change.
Without adequate commitments from every nation in this room, the goal of limiting and warming to 1.5 degrees slips through our hands, and that is a disaster.
Right now, that goal is far out of reach. A new UN analysis released today shows emissions are set to keep rising this decade, and the world is on track to warm about 2.7 degrees Celsius, or almost 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Only about half of countries signed on to the Paris Climate Accord have submitted updated carbon-cutting targets. That's supposed to happen before the Glasgow summit. Biden said today that he was grateful to the countries who've upped their targets, but said there's urgent work to do still.
We have to bring to Glasgow our highest possible ambitions. Those that have not yet done so, time is running out.
The Glasgow summit is at risk of failure. That is the bottom line from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who spoke to Reuters this week. A key reason why, he says, is distrust between developed and developing countries. That's partly because richer nations have not yet delivered on a promise to mobilize $100 billion a year for developing nations. Mohamed Addo is the director of Power Shift Africa.
These countries actually require financing, for them to be able to transition to renewables, but also to be able to adapt to the changing climate.
Addo says delivering a concrete plan for dispersing these funds would be key to breaking the deadlock going into the UN climate summit.
How can we actually trust the rich world if they can't deliver on the promises they made 11 years ago? And so this is so important and so critical for the success of Glasgow.
The UN General Assembly kicks off high-level meetings in New York next week. Any new announcements on climate finance or temperature targets there will show the road to Glasgow is a little less rocky than it currently looks. So would any nod from China that it'll cut coal usage, says Rachel Kite, dean at the Fletcher School of International Affairs at Tufts University.
So is there anything that China can say publicly about coal, so peaking, ending financing overseas? So I think that's one thing that people are looking for.
U.S. climate envoy John Kerry has been crisscrossing the world all year trying to lay the groundwork for a successful climate summit this fall. His meetings with China so far have yielded no big breakthroughs, but Kerry struck a cautiously optimistic tone at the virtual meeting today, saying he's been very encouraged by much of what he's seen during his travels.
I believe that we will achieve a global net zero economy. The question remains, however, whether we will do it as quickly as we must and avoid the worst consequences of the climate crisis.
The host in Glasgow will be UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He's holding another meeting Monday at the UN, which, much like Biden's meeting today, is aimed at boosting global ambition on addressing climate change. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
On Monday, Canadian voters head to the polls again. The unexpected vote takes place just 2 years after Canada's last federal election. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called for the vote in mid-August, and he now faces four other candidates. Freelance reporter Leyland Checo in Toronto has been closely following the race. Leyland, remind us why Prime Minister Trudeau called for the vote in the first place.
In 2019, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau won a minority government, meaning his party didn't quite get the 170 seats needed to govern without the consent of other parties. He realizes that minority governments are an unstable form of governing, that, you know, they're prone to snap elections. And so he kind of looked out. He has two more years left until the next election will be called. And there's been about four elections in Canada during the pandemic in provinces, and all of those elections except one have produced majorities for the governing party. So I think Trudeau kind of looked at the math, looked at the writing on the wall and said, you know what, this is probably my best shot to kind of roll the dice and see if I can get a majority in a vote on Monday.
And tell us a bit about Trudeau's opponents.
Obviously, his closest rival is Conservative leader Erin O'Toole. O'Toole's pretty fresh face in the leadership, so we've never really kind of seen him on the public stage as leader. And kind of unlike the Republican Party in the U.S., he's run as an ally of the LGBTQ community. He is a pro-choice conservative, and he is, you know, running on a platform that looks to kind of bolster rights for gig workers in the economy. You know, compared to the United States, at least, like, these parties are definitely hewing to the left in terms of their platform.
What about Trudeau's other challengers? Who are they?
Well, Jagmeet Singh is the NDP, the New Democratic Party leader, and he is an incredibly popular politician in Canada. He's kind of just seen as like this honest, very well-liked popular politician. He runs laps around O'Toole and Trudeau when it comes to popularity. But because the way Canada's electoral system works, like, he has an effective vote ceiling that's not going to get him, you know, make him prime minister anytime soon. But he does have the chance of becoming a kingmaker on Monday, where if neither the Liberals or Conservatives get to that magic 170 number, like, he might hold the balance of power and really be able to kind of nudge his party's more progressive direction.
So what have the major issues of this race been so far?
The major issues in the race so far haven't really been what we thought they were going to be. Canada has been grappling with the discovery of unmarked graves at former residential schools across the country. We had terrible fire season out west in which an entire community was destroyed. So a lot of people kind of thought climate change and reconciliation with Indigenous communities would be top of line. Those haven't been the issues. The parties have really run on questions of affordability and really just the election a lot of the time has been questions about why we're having an election in the first place.
How might the pandemic affect the vote in terms of turnout or in terms of it being a kind of judgment on how Justin Trudeau has handled the pandemic?
We don't quite yet know, because we've never really held a federal election during a kind of a public health emergency. And so Elections Canada, which is this federal body that administers the election, they've sent out mail-in ballots that people can use. They have advanced voting, but they've also said they're about 40,000 people short the amount they were hoping to hire. So there's questions about how fast the ballots will be counted. There's questions about, you know, voter turnout, which really skews the polling. And you know, if you're Justin Trudeau, you were probably looking at the four provincial elections that happened that produced legislative majorities. Probably thought, you know, Canadians might not be angry at us for calling a vote, but, you know, we're going to see on Monday whether or not that is the case.
I understand Justin Trudeau was attacked recently by anti-vaccination activists. What happened there?
We still have about 20% of the country not yet vaccinated. And those 20% are increasingly vocal on the campaign trail. So they've really been kind of dogging a lot of his events and times hurling obscenities at him. And then a couple of weeks ago, protesters hurled gravel at the prime minister and the people around him. And I think that kind of marked a turning point in how these anti-vaccine protests have been seen. But it does feel like it's had an animating force for the prime minister, who is a person that we know loves to be on the campaign trail. Like, he's a popular guy. He's a charismatic person, and he loves to be out shaking hands. So I think the anti-vaccine protesters have maybe kind of just shifted the calculus a bit for the prime minister in what he expected he'd be seen on the campaign trail.
Bottom line, Leyland, what's the likely outcome here?
I think at this point, the Liberals look likely to get a minority government again. And that's largely because the way the voting is concentrated and the seats are allocated, the Conservative vote is kind of inefficient. They have big support out west in the prairies, but you kind of got to win those seats in the more populous areas. So numbers right now look like the Liberals are probably going to get their minority again. Could be majority, depending on how, you know, coins flip, you know, in a number of different districts. But, you know, the prime minister, again, you know, it took a gamble, and we're going to see whether or not it pays off.
Leyland Checo is a freelance journalist based in Toronto, where he's been closely following Canada's federal elections set to take place on Monday. Thanks a lot, Leyland.
I really appreciate you guys having me.
Of the Mexican indie rock band Zoé are pumped. The Grammy-winning five-piece band is going on 25 years and shows no signs of stopping. They're currently on the road here in the U.S., promoting their seventh album, Sonidos de Karmática Resonancia. Called SKR by Zoé is on the more poppy side of the album. Frontman Leon Larraguet says the first side was written and recorded before pandemic-related lockdowns were implemented in Mexico. The second half of the album was finished in December after strict lockdowns were lifted. The time in between was spent on what Larraguet says was a forced vacation. Time spent reading, writing, and quality time with family. Here's one of Zoé's quieter tunes from the second side, the forced vacation part of the album. You can listen to more new music on our Spotify playlist, including other global hits from artists we featured on the show. You can find a link to it on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. Jesus Chue Negrete was often called the Chicano Woody Guthrie. The folk singer grew up on the south side of Chicago and was beloved in Mexican-American communities across the country. He passed away this spring at age 72. Earlier this week, a remembrance was held in Chicago. WBEZ's Linda Lutton has this story about Negrete's life and music.
If you ever ran into Chuy Negrete, it's likely you never forgot him. Cowboy hat, salt and pepper goatee, full of jokes and stories set to song. His guitar and harmonica were like parts of his body.
Vámonos para el norte. Vámonos a trabajar. Vámonos para Chicago.
Imagine having a songwriter who accompanied you through life, followed you from one country to the next, and sang of your trials and victories, your history. That's what Chuy Negrete did for Mexican immigrants and their children. Here he's singing about the jobs lots of Mexican immigrants come north for. I picked cherries in Minnesota, took care of dogs in North Dakota, I worked the mines of Arizona.
California, me fui.
Negrete lived the experience he sang about. He was born in Mexico and spent his early years in Texas, where his parents were migrant workers. When he was 7, his family moved to South Chicago for work in the steel mills. Negrete's language was the corrido, Mexican ballads he used to document the immigrant experience and highlight social and political causes.
We're talking to Jesu Chuy, nicknamed Negrete, who is, you can gather, quite a folklorist and singer and historian. You're, in a sense, you're an oral historian with song.
Radio great Studs Terkel interviewed Negrete in 1997. Negrete talked about the role of the corrido in the Mexican Revolution, how it was a sort of newspaper set to song.
Because in 1910, the Mexican population was basically 80% illiterate. So they used this oral tradition to keep alive their history and to make political commentary. It was their story, it was their history books. The corrido then is to the Chicano, the Mexican-American, what the blues is to the black man.
Negrete adopted and adapted the corrido, bringing it onto the streets of Chicago and into the modern labor and Chicano rights movements nationally.
Wherever there was a protest, Chuy would be found there.
That's Jesus Chuy Garcia, the Illinois congressman. He knew Negrete for decades.
Whether it was in the back of a pickup truck, in a parking lot, he would be there and he would play his heart out.
Trabajadores de mi raza.
Negrete was brilliantly spontaneous. If he was singing on a picket line, his lyrics would mention strikers right there walking the line.
Oh, Armando Robles.
Oh, yeah. He was organic. He was in real time.
At community festivals, his lyrics would incorporate the señoras making enchiladas. If a kid toddled by, he'd work him in, too.
He would say, hey, mocosito, how we doing? Play with the kid and then get back to the story that he was telling. And he was just able to pluck people out of their situation and, you know, bring them into the song and then go back to the larger storytelling. That was one of his gifts. And he was so good and so comfortable at it.
Yo soy Mexicano.
Negrete grew up hearing his dad's classic Mexican music. He learned to perform at the nearby church, Our Lady of Guadalupe, and by his early 20s, he was organizing other young people, including three of his sisters, into theater and singing troupes that toured the U.S. and highlighted Chicano culture and history with biting critiques about the treatment of farm workers and the state of education for Latino youth. One of his presentations went through 500 years of Chicano history, starting in pre-Hispanic times. He sang in English, Spanish, and the indigenous language, Nahuatl.
How can I begin to express to you what America means to la raza? It means that we were Americanos before the name America had ever existed.
Negrete always saw himself as a scholar and educator. He lectured at universities across the country and was often invited by Latino student groups hungry to learn more about their heritage. He believed folk music was integral to political struggle. Here he is in 1980 on a University of Texas radio program.
Music is one of the elements that is most utilized, you know, by our people. We listen to it, we sing our children to bed with it. So what you do is that you utilize the element that is most utilized by the people. You educate people, they educate themselves. You mix the political with the cultural.
And Negrete was funny. His lyrics were full of Mexican humor. They often involved foibles around learning English. He poked fun at the powerful and always gave the little guy the last laugh. Like in this clip, where Negrete tells of a migrant who thinks an English-speaking border agent has just told him, "Hi, idiot," in Spanish. He responds right back with the same greeting.
You going on the highway? Highway? Oh, pues, hello, way.
The audience delights in the idea of a migrant telling off a border agent without him ever knowing. Negrete was deeply embedded in the Chicano movement nationwide. He played at Cesar Chavez's United Farm Worker rallies. Actor Edward James Olmos was a friend. He once crashed on the floor of the family's Chicago home. Negrete's wife, Rita Rousseau, and older son Joaquin saw him straddle two worlds.
Important to a large population, inspiring to a large population, completely unknown to a larger Anglo society.
You know, he is so beloved within his community and part of so many cultural
touchstones and points in history in the United States. But like you said,
right.
He's the most famous, unfamous person.
Negrete loved people. He loved to perform. As his health declined over the past few years, and then during the pandemic, he turned to his radio show, which aired on Loyola University Station.
Así es, raza. Bienvenidos. Al nuevo Radio Rebelde.
He broadcast from his dining room table, and of course he wrote corridos about the coronavirus.
Recordando a los muertos.
His family is pulling together Negrete's many songs, documenting a half century of political struggle and cultural pride for Mexican Americans. For The World, I'm Linda Lutton.
If George Washington was my father, why wasn't he Chicano? Yo soy Chicano, and I'm proud, and I know I can do it in my own good way.
Many thanks to the Studs Terkel Radio Archive. You can hear a playlist of Chuy Negrete's songs at WBEZ.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
Chicano. Yo soy Chicano, and I'm proud, and I know I can do it in my own way. And all across the USA, from Michigan to LA, Chicano, soy Chicano, right on. Vámonos para el norte. Vámonos a trabajar, vámonos para el norte. Vámonos a trabajar.